Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Christoph Odinets, and today I have the great pleasure of speaking with Alex Panasenko, author of The Long Vacation, his memoir of the Second World War, published last year by Iris Press. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
I'd like to add on a personal note that I met Alex 30 years ago when I had the privilege of being his biology student at Berkeley High School in California. When Alex was born in 1933, his native Ukraine was devastated by Stalin's program of starvation, the Holodomor. Millions were murdered through starvation, somewhere between 3 and 10 millions. Then came Stalin's political purges, killing some hundreds of thousands, deporting millions more, and eviscerating the Soviet officer corps just in time for Hitler's 1941 invasion when Alex was about 8 years old. This book is about the next 4 years, a coming-of-age story when Alex and his family were deported by the Nazis for slave labor, and the story moves you west, along with him and his family, until the war ends beyond. I think there's a saying from Malawi, perhaps, that when elephants fight, it is the grass that suffers, and there's no nastier elephants that I can think of than Hitler and Stalin. A male born in the Ukraine in 1933 had the life expectancy of 7.5 years, and here you are in 2021. you also write that you are not sure you'd like to be called a survivor. Why not?
Well, it's so very passive, you know. I mean, no doubt I am a survivor. However, I would like to think, you know, that maybe I had something to do with it, you know, the masculine bit.
Well, give us would you please read to us from the first part of chapter two? I think it will give our listeners a really good idea of your narrative and your prose.
That winter was the absolute low point of my life. There were others to follow, being in a labor camp and being dumped by wives and lovers without whom one tasted a terrible desolation. But those were things that happened to a very large number of normal people. What occurred in a winter of 41-42 in a couple of cities like Leningrad and Kharkov was reserved for the elect. Of course, I was too young, too insignificant to have been one of the elect. I, in any event, liked the sort of arrogance, the sort of gall that it would take to claim the place of job on a dunghill. But I must have stood somewhere near the elect when their fate was cast, and some of it settled on me. The day after the Germans took the city, I awoke to find the streets outside shrouded in autumnal fog. Echoing through the fog, I heard an ominous sound that was to be a part of my life for the next 4 years, the clacking of hobnailed Wehrmacht boots on cobblestone streets. I scrambled outside to observe the source of the sound. They appeared like creatures of the fog emerging from the mist. They usually patrolled in pairs, outfitted with steel helmets, unfamiliar weapons, gray uniforms, and black cartridge belts. On the backs of the belts were small bags and flat bayonets. They wore cylindrical fluted steel containers, which I was later to learn contained gas masks. Their faces were mostly distant and grim. They were immediately different, unmistakably alien. Compared to our soldiers, they were neater, cleaner, better equipped, better disciplined, and far less human. Years later, I discovered myself acting in a distant and alien manner to other people in another war. So maybe the Germans were as human as we were, or perhaps they were merely as efficient at teaching as they seemed to be at everything else. Certainly, they had more effect on my development than did any other group, and perhaps they still do. These advancing German troops replaced the retreating Soviet troops. Long lines of German horse carts replaced long lines of Russian horse carts, all moving east. Since water and electric facilities had been blown up by the retreating Russians, lines formed for the few surviving wells that were still functional. The civilian population needed the water for drinking. The Germans needed it for their horses. This led to conflicts of interest. My father, while standing in line, observed a Russian who also had been waiting for several hours finally get his bucket of water. A German walked up to him and tried to take it from him. The Russian refused. The German unceremoniously shot the Russian and calmly watered his horses. Germans were not only efficient, they also loved animals.
This work is beautifully written, but the things you endured are ugly as hell and very raw. And there's something about a child's account of World War II with all the crazy things the adults did. I don't know how many we have. I can think of Anne Frank, who sort of remained a child because she was hidden away, and Jerzy Kosinski, who certainly did not because of all the horrors he saw.
People here, or I should say there now, I guess it's just a difference in time, but all these adjectives that are being thrown around, you know, ugly and inhuman and all that, back then, that was normal. See, that was just how things were. That was normal life.
Was there a time when you remember seeing these things first as a younger child, maybe in a period of famine, or it was always?
Well, originally, I was shocked by things, but then in that part of the book when I'm describing walking through town during the battle, and I see these three Russians hanging out the back of their self-propelled gun and burning, I did not perceive this as particularly frightening. I was curious. I hadn't realized that people could burn.
So all rules seem suspended, which that too has a child absolutely feeling.
Absolutely. Yeah. You are submerged in a completely, totally different reality.
Is that why it's the long vacation?
Well, I call it the long vacation because the war started during the first week that I was in grammar school. And then I did not go back to school until 1947. And that's the period that I describe. So that's why I called it the long vacation.
So do you find, maybe it's a dumb question, but do you find that you were accustomed and acculturated to this wildness?
Totally. When I first came over here in 1949, I thought that people here were a little bit strange. It took me several years to really admit to myself that it was I who was a little bit strange. I mean, normalcy, after all, is a function of numbers.
Yeah, that's true. And also because the Americans hadn't had a war on their own soil in a long time.
So. Yes, of course.
But you feel kinship to GIs who would come back and, I have had a very comfortable life, I must admit. But when you read, for example, William Manchester in the Pacific War, he talks about after killing some Japanese on an island, he goes into a cave and he has this apparition of the whore of death, and she's covered in maggots, and it's terror and violence and lust in one being. And I think you talk about when you were 8 years old, terror, hunger, and lust shaped your days.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's pretty much what kept me alive. Otherwise, I would have just sort of sunken into a torpor and died like a lot of people did.
And so, yeah, when you meet, and interrupt me anytime, but when you meet up with your family again after being separated for some time, you have adapted into a different creature
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely. I saw them as losers. And, well, you know, I supported them. I went on the black market. I kept them alive. I am still not certain whether it was a good thing or not that I ran into them after the war. If I had not, being the being that I was at the time, being the creature that I was at that time, I might have become some sort of mighty entrepreneur, you know, and married lots of movie actresses and been wealthy, instead of being sucked back into this middle class lifestyle.
Did you ever adapt back to the middle class lifestyle or not? Really?
Not completely.
So tell us, summarize for our listeners, what happened when you were separated from your family until you, I mean, that's the most of the book, but sort of so we understand how many times were you on your own and how, where did you find survival? And
well, actually, I was not on my own for that long. It was just several months. But the effect was incredible because... suddenly, I was liberated from the tyranny of parents, from the tyranny of organized society. And I was put into a completely different milieu. And I realized that really there was only I was central. Everything else was pretty much a dream. And I had to see to myself. I had to create my own ethos. I had to create my own set of rules, my own morals, if you will, by which to survive. And I realized that, well, being a kid, right, I was 11 years old, and I realized that children were tyrannized by their parents, by society. I guess I became an anarchist of sorts. And I viewed the adults, the adult world, as the enemy, because after all, it was the adults that started the war. It was the adults that were doing all the killing, all the bombing, all, you know, starving of people. And I felt like the war was a war of adults against children. And started dreaming about organizing children into a mighty army, right? And conquering the adult world.
Well, one thing that's not in the book is much about your own childhood back in their family before all of this happens. And we meet your brother, I think, when you meet him again in, I think it might be Austria. But tell us what it was like before everything fell apart.
Well, both of my parents were university professors. My mother was a total liberal and I suppose a feminist. My father came from a Cossack family who were famous in their district for being sort of homicidal nuts. And he raised me the way he was raised. When he was a child, he was jumping. All the boys were, you know, racing horses and they were jumping him over a ravine and his horse fell in and broke its legs, and he broke his leg. And so in order to punish him for this, his father just let him crawl around the hut all night long with a broken leg. So, you know, he was raised in that sort of a culture. So he used to beat me a lot. It would have been more or less okay if... there had been a reason for it, but sometimes there was no reason for it. He just, you know, let loose and beat me up. So I held that against him for practically until the day he died.
And that was normal.
Yeah, that was considered normal. Yeah.
Yeah. So, right. So if every boy in your class has the same home life, you're like, that's just the way things are.
Well, not all of them. I mean, some of them, not all of them had crazy fathers, you know.
Yeah. And your mom, your mother, the feminist?
My mother was Polish. Her last name was Jaskulska. And her father came supposedly from from lower level Polish nobility, and she was a very genteel woman. She was wonderful, really, except, as I said, you know, she was a liberal and a feminist.
Well, yeah, I think in Poland, there's something like 10% of people who are, who dig potatoes with gloves on. That's how you know that they are.
Right.
So this is the Soviet Union. Is there talk of times, you know, do you feel occupied by the Russians, or this is just the way it has always been?
Well, I was raised to consider the Polacks, the Russians, and the Tartars to be my traditional enemies.
Yeah, so you are a Cossack through and through.
goes back to those Zaporozhian Cossacks, right?
Yes. Yes, and they all, certainly Poland, and I'm sure the others consider Ukraine their natural domain. So it's a tough neighborhood.
Having read Sienkiewicz as Ognem I Mieczem, right? Yes. I can see it from the Polish side as well.
Yes. I think that really informs a bit of the story that chaos and violence is nothing new. How about the hunger? You talk about a well-timed bag of alfalfa.
You're totally, completely preoccupied with the idea of food. And in fact, to some degree, I still am. You know, I got like 50 pounds of beans stored away for the next famine. So it does change you. I described this old woman who used to show up at our house and watch us eat, right, during the famine. And then she started talking about how nice and plump I was, and my father chased her out the house and she died on our doorstep. She was totally crazed, you know, she was just sitting there drooling like a dog.
So, you bring us back to Hansel and Gretel, I think, is those were not as...
Exactly. Hansel and Gretel ate the witch, which is not generally told in your politically correct fairy tales, but in the original fairy tale, they throw in the oven and bake her and eat her.
In your town, and I think this is where you're separated when your father is working somewhere in the big city, and you're in the small town, and the Germans execute some prisoners. Those prisoners end up as cat meat or dog meat, so-called.
That was in the big city. That was in Kharkov. And in fact, Sally, who did a lot of research on my book and actually, found factual supports for some of the things I write about. Yeah, she found a picture of these people hanging off a balcony in Kharkov. So the Germans would hang them. What would happen, they would go down the street and take somebody out of every 10th house. And then they would keep them for 2 weeks as hostages. And if during that time somebody killed a German, they would take 10 of these guys out and hang them off a balcony. And so then by next day, they'd be cut down, and even though there were orders against it. And people would be selling this pink hamburger that they said was dog meat. But of course, everybody knew that it was not dog meat. It was hostage meat.
Yeah, and the dog meat is a fig leaf to cover.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely.
So how about Germans? Do Germans have this tradition, or are they aliens from outer space from a very different background when they show up, in addition to the fact that they love their animals?
Yes. Well, that was me being funny.
Yes.
Although they do. They really do. And... I'm a dog owner now, and feeling the way I do about dogs, I'd rather eat hostages than dogs.
But for example, there was a German woman on a train who sort of took you under her wing.
Yes, she looked very nice. She looked very sympathetic, very kind. So I started helping her carrying her bag. But then she starts being all maternal. She starts being all parental. And of course, I'm scared shitless of parents and of adults at this point. And it was at this point that I decided to get the hell away from her, because she was threatening, to take the place of parents.
Well, and you seem to feel like you tell her, "Leider bin ich Untermensch." Like, unfortunately, I am not fully human, right? She doesn't understand.
Yes. She starts coming on all maternal, and I said, unfortunately, I'm a subhuman.
Yeah.
Which was my official designation, right? Untermensch.
Yes. And you had a patch on your arm that said Ost?
No, but at this point, I had taken the patch off. It was not, we did not wear it on the arm. It was on the left side of our jackets. And it was white and blue, and it said Ost, which meant East, which, you know, to everybody who knew just meant, you know, Untermensch.
Did you feel that the Slavic culture with its violence was from a different tradition than these Germans who were coming in, perpetrating every kind of violence, but somehow?
Well, the thing is, the Soviet government, of course, was quite violent too. Matter of fact, I remember during the purges, you know, we had these NKVD troopers walking down the street, and me and the other kids would run up to them and ask, you know, hey, can we see your gun? How many people did you liquidate? And I played with a lot of kids whose parents had been liquidated, and the kids just lived out on the street. They lived in sewers and basements and whatnot. I was forbidden to talk to them, but of course I made friends with them and played with them. And I told you about, I wrote about this game we had where we would sit the kid on a chair and start hitting him, screaming, confess, you son of a bitch. And after he'd taken as much as he could, he would say, I confess. And then we'd shoot him in the head with the cap gun. And then it would be somebody else's turn, right, to be the spy. And we were NKVD.
Children are almost,
kids. Yeah. You know, these are 6 and 7 year old kids playing this game.
But you're almost invisible. You can move in and out of this disastrous world and walk up to a soldier and tease him or taunt him or an old lady
Right. Could not do that with a German. And it wasn't just the language. There was a cultural difference. Kids did not talk to German soldiers.
So what about being a slave? Does that stick with you? Is it burned into your... Did you imagine it would end?
It's so totally burned into me that they still, at times, have to fight against it.
Say more about that. Did you imagine it would ever end when you were a child, or did you not have a future tense, you know?
Well, I never expected to live very long. I was hoping to live until I was 12. And then, especially after the war, when I got rounded up by the MPs at the black market, and they gave me a medical checkup and, you know, discovered that they had TB. And of course, in the camps, TB was a death sentence. So I was absolutely, totally certain, you know, that I was going to die soon. And then, damn it, I stayed alive and had to cope with life. It's very easy when you think that you're going to die, because you just don't have to worry about the future very much.
Focuses the mind as a...
Yeah, absolutely. You're just focusing on getting enough to eat that particular day.
Yeah. Well, one of the most positive parts of this is when you are a black market racketeer at the end of the war. You endure everything. You go from place to place. You somehow survive the Stalin. You survive Hitler. You find yourself in ally-occupied. Is it Munich or Vienna where you are?
No. Memmingen. It was a small town called Memmingen.
Memmingen,
which is in a very picturesque part of Bavaria. Beautiful little town. And it survived totally except for the railroad station that got bombed all to shit. But all railroad stations were.
I was there as a tourist in 1997 during Oktoberfest, and it made me think of every German fairy tale, with its dark forest and its sunlit hills. And
yes, and those houses with the timbers on the outside, and they had, you know, they have all these heraldic designs painted on the houses.
So here you are in this beautiful medieval German city. You have survived, though we won't call you a survivor, because you were extremely active and cunning in a childlike way. and you suddenly find yourself the possessor of coffee.
Yes, I'm suddenly, money didn't mean anything. I mean, I was a possessor of food. I was a possessor of cigarettes and liquor and evaporated milk. Those were the three big sellers.
It was some accident that a guy said, "Hey, kid, you want some coffee?" And then you traded that for the other.
What happened was they had the Germans had a PW camp nearby that was full of Russian prisoners. And I was walking down the street, and here come these guys in bits and pieces of Soviet uniforms talking Russian. And I started talking to them. And they said, "You know, hey, kid, you know, how come you're here?" And I said, "Well, I was, you know, in a German work camp." And they said, "Why don't you come and visit us in a camp and bring a big bag?" So I did. They were getting American Army rations. And so they filled the bag up with all kinds of goodies, and I took it back, gave them to my mother, who started handing all this food out to her friends. I told you, you know, she was a liberal and a feminist. So she started handing all this food out to these other people who, you know, had university degrees and whatnot. And they were terribly judgmental of me because I was, you know, not a proper European, you know, middle-class boy. I was pretty wild. So I did this for a while, and the number of her friends increased dramatically because she was giving food out. And then this Latvian guy said, "How come you're giving all this stuff away? Why don't you sell it on the black market?" And just about this time, I went to this PW camp and went to their kitchen, and their cook was opening all these American ration boxes, and one of them is full of Nestle cans, right? It had the little nest and birds on it, and he sticks a knife in it, and some brown powder comes out, and he tastes it, and he says, "This is shit. This is coffee. Our people don't drink coffee. Our people drink tea. You want all this shit, kid?" And I said, "Sure." So he gave me all this coffee, which was worth its weight in gold because the Germans hadn't had any coffee for years, and they're a nation of coffee drinkers and beer drinkers, of course. So I had all this coffee, and I started swapping it for booze, from the Germans' booze to the Americans for cigarettes, cigarettes back to the Germans. It was really a going concern. Incidentally, I have never really smoked because I discovered while I was in a camp that smokers, man, they would die for a cigarette. They would trade their bread ration for a cigarette. It was, well, after the war, you know, you could have any German woman for half a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah, I remember in Anne Frank, she collects bits of tobacco from sweater pockets and makes it into a cigarette for whoever she's hiding with, her uncle or grandfather.
Yes,
and
yes.
What a precious gift that was. And it's hard to imagine in a time now where so few people smoke, at least in the United States. I know people smoke all over the place, but it's... I also imagine that as a child who didn't have to smoke yet, why would you ever burn such wealth?
Well, of course, when I was a little kid, I tried smoking, and it seemed kind of repulsive. And then one time I found a ruble on the street, and I took it to the grocery store and bought a ruble bottle of vodka. And myself and these two other little kids drank the whole damn bottle, and we were found lying passed out in puddles of vomit.
So this period in Memmingen, did you say it went to 1947?
It went to 1947.
So you were doing this for 2 years.
Right. Well, no, because I spent 9 months in the sanitarium.
Well, you were doing this for a year?
Yeah, I did it until I got rounded up by the MPs along with a bunch of other people. And I had a gun in my pocket. I was packing a 25 automatic at age 12. And the MP who found the gun asked me if I was German. I said, no, I'm Russian. So he said, oh, okay, and dropped the gun in his pocket, and I got away with it.
Yeah. Was it a dangerous racket?
Well, it was. And some of the other black market dealers went around armed, and so I was emulating them, right?
Yeah. Talk about, I think you have a special appreciation for firearms. I remember fondly when I was in high school and we went on one of our camping trips and you taught me how to use a handgun. I'd used rifles and shotguns in the Boy Scouts, but it was with one of our trips where I first held a gun. And I was thinking back to that time when you were writing in your book that there, when you were very young, some Wehrmacht soldiers asked you to watch their rifles where they were having lunch or something. And you wrote, I sat on the steps and looked at the guns. They looked lethal as hell with a dull, oily film on them. I touched one and slid my finger down the cool side of its receiver. Here was the root and expression of all power. This was the divine right of kings, the popular will of democracy, democracies, and the proletarian might of the socialist republics.
Yes. Well, in the Soviet Union, of course, it was a capital offense to own a firearm. And only the NKVD and the police went around armed. So naturally, I started viewing guns, you know, as authority, as power, as, well, just about everything in life. So then the war came along and did not do anything to disenchant me, to disprove that theory. So I totally believe that people should be armed in order to be able to withstand the government.
Is it fair to say that you've seen so many systems fall apart and laws and things written on paper might not be dependable, but if you have
Absolutely. I saw the Soviet Union fall apart. I saw the Third Reich fall apart. And there was no one you could go to. There was only you.
Yeah. And one of the most powerful sections is right at the end, where you, as a young man, try out a hand grenade. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think I was 13 at the time, and I was at the bombed-out rail yard, and there was all this equipment scattered around from the war still. Railroad cars sitting up on end, huge bomb craters. And I put on a German helmet and picked up a couple of hand grenades. And I was running from bomb crater to bomb crater playing at war. And then I decided to throw one of the hand grenades. There was a bit of a house left, and I had some unbroken windows in the cellar. And that particular type of hand grenade, long handle, explosive head, you unscrew a cap, and there's a ceramic ball attached to a silk or nylon cord. And you yank out the cord, which initiates a powder train, and then you have 4 seconds or so until the thing goes off. So I unscrewed the cap and a ceramic ball falls out, and I yank out the cord and pull back my arm to throw the grenade through the window. And at that point, I think I see somebody, some old woman, moving behind the window. And after that, things become very dreamlike, very automatic. My arm goes back by itself. I don't seem to have any control over it, and it snaps forward, and the grenade goes through the window, and I put my face down in my arms, and the thing goes off, and I go running off.
Does this make you
This makes me like everybody else in the war. This suddenly makes me the equal of, you know, the German soldiers and the Russian soldiers and everybody else, because by God, now I've done what they did, right?
Yeah. And until then, children sort of move around invisibly.
Up until then, I was a slave. And now suddenly, you know, I'm a slave with a hand grenade.
Yeah. Which is a big difference, which is why you can't have guns in the Soviet Union.
Right.
Okay. No religion in your upbringing, or in your village, in your town?
Well, no, because the Soviet government had arrested all the priests, right? Religion being opium for the people and all that kind of thing. And I did not see a priest until I was in this camp where one showed up, Russian priest, and he asked me about, you know, God, and I laughed at him and proceeded to tell him the party line about religion being opium for the people. And he said, why don't you let me baptize you? And I said, what's that? And he said, well, if you get baptized, you get a guardian angel to watch over you. And I said, is that like somebody from the NKVD? And the guy said, well, you know, if you let me baptize you, I'll give you a piece of bread. Hell, for a piece of bread, I would have let him fuck me. So I said, sure, okay. And so I got baptized.
There was a moment when maybe you're in a bomb shelter or someplace, and there's some, anyway, the danger is very imminent. And
yes,
there's an old lady praying.
Yes, there's this. That was incredible. I was by myself then, and at this one railway stop, I got off the train, and there was a family there who had known me and my parents when we were at this scientist camp. And they said that, well, yeah, there's this place about a kilometer away where they're trying to sort out our people, so maybe you can find your family there. So I went there. Bunch of Russians. House was a basement. And my parents were not there. And so while I'm hanging around wondering whether I should go back to the railway station or not, along comes this formation of B-17s. It was a sunny day, and we could see the planes very clearly, and we could see their bomb base opening, and we could see the bombs come falling out. And the first ones were some kind of tracer bombs. They produced this dark brown smoke trail, and they were heading straight for the railway station. So we all go running into the basement, and the bombs start going off, and the windows go flying out, and a bomb blasts, you know, pick you right up off the ground and then smash you down again. And this old woman starts praying. So what the hell, I figured it couldn't do any harm, so I start praying too. And this Russian guy says, hey, kid, you know, you're acting like a cunt. If you don't stop this shit, I'll start praying too. So I stopped.
And you admired him, you said.
Yeah.
That made sense.
Yeah. Absolutely. The man had balls. He had courage.
Yeah. And that's what counts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Whatever happened to your family? I know you were separated from them.
Yes, and then I found them, and then we came over here.
All together.
And my father, who had been a researcher of some note in the Soviet Union, got a job as a janitor at the supermarket, or rather a department store. And because in the Soviet Union, you know, the government assigned you a job and you kept that job forever, he never bothered to do anything else. He just stayed a janitor until the end of his life.
May I ask you about how you got to the United States? This is beyond the scope of the book at this point. And
yes, please. A mutual friend knew somebody in San Francisco and persuaded the guy in San Francisco to sponsor us. And so we came over as displaced persons.
And you settled, now is your mother and father and brother also?
Settled in San Francisco.
Yeah. And you went to school here and became an entomologist?
Right. I went to Polytechnic High School in San Francisco and then joined the Army during the Korean War. And then worked in a factory for a couple of years, in a machine shop, actually. Then went to UC Berkeley for 7 years and became a high school teacher.
Why entomology, may I ask?
Well, I started out in journalism. Then I switched over to history of art because that's where all the girls were. And then I had to take some science classes for breadth requirement, so I took biology. I was sort of anti-biology because my father, of course, was a biologist, and I hated him. So suddenly I discovered I really liked biology. But biology had no practical applications, I mean pure biology. So I switched over to entomology because you could become either a forest entomologist or an agricultural entomologist. There were plenty of jobs available in those areas.
And, okay, that's very practical. Now, what is being a soldier yourself? Teach you about having been a child.
I just should not discuss that, except to say I was a U.S. paratrooper. Whoa, the best of the best, all that shit.
Did it affect how you thought of your childhood back, thinking of soldiers that you met as a child?
I became somewhat Germanic for a while and then woke up to the fact that I was becoming somewhat Germanic and went back to being human.
And then you came back in the 60s and 70s, and were a high school teacher for how long?
40 years. I took the job for 1 year. I had a bit of a falling out. I was going for a doctorate and had a bit of a falling out. And the dean of the School of Agriculture said, well, Alex, you know, Berkeley High are looking for somebody overqualified to teach their gifted kids. So why don't you take the job for a year and then come back? So I took the job for a year. And my feelings about kids versus adults came back, and I totally identified with the students rather than the administration. And so I stayed for 40 years.
Well, I'm very glad you did, as a beneficiary of your teaching. And not only do I remember biology and shooting, but you also taught us how to ferment juice.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I had the kids chip in and buy apple juice. And that was actually an experiment that was in a syllabus. We were supposed to do that. However, in the syllabus, we were supposed to ferment one test tube. And my class fermented several gallons. And then I taught them how to filter the stuff. And then I would say, well, you know, and then I would give them a lecture on the evils of alcohol. Yeah, straight factual lecture about cirrhosis and all that other stuff. And then I would say that I find alcohol so repulsive that I can't stand the smell of it. So I'm going to walk out into the hallway for 15 minutes. And during those 15 minutes, I want you guys to pour all that stuff out into the drain. And I would walk out into the hallway for 15 minutes and I would come back and all these kids would be sitting there with lopsided grins.
And sure enough, it was all gone. So clearly they poured it away.
And then we built a still and I started teaching them distillation. And the stuff that came out, you could touch a match to it and it would go up, you know, in a blue flame. I gave a pint of it to one of the school janitors. And the guy missed work for a week. And when he came back, he kept bugging me to give him more of the stuff, which I didn't have by then.
But he did not go blind.
Right. He did not go up in flame.
So on the last page of the book, about the author, you say, up till now, Alex Panasenko has been a slave laborer in Nazi Germany, a factory worker, a soldier in the U.S. Army during the Korean War, a graduate student in entomology at UC Berkeley, a science instructor at Berkeley High School, and a bartender. In only a few more years, he will be 100, at which point he plans to decide what to do with his life. In the meantime, he is biding his time cooking for his wife, Sally, and dog, Lucy, in Portland, Oregon. What do you plan to be when you grow up, Alex?
Well, growing up seems like an incredible chore. You know, it's like Sisyphus pushing that rock up the hill. And I do hope that by year 100, I'll get to the top and, you know, suddenly things will be revealed to me, which I do not know at the moment. And I will know what to do with my life.
Do you find the world in the 21st century any better than the worst parts of the 20th? Have we learned our lessons?
I find it alien. I find it very difficult to relate to some things.
For example, or are people isolated in their individual?
Yes, yeah. Isolated in their computers. I walked into a bar once and there were all these young people sitting there and they were talking into little plastic boxes instead of to each other. And I found that very strange.
Do you feel the governments are any better? We have probably twice the democracies, I imagine, that we had in 1933, maybe three times, and the empires are vanishing. Or is it a facade?
A dictatorship tells people what to do. A democracy swindles people into what to do. At least ours does.
How long would you like to live?
Pardon?
How long would you like to live, ideally, with all medical...
Ideally?
Yeah.
Well, frankly, I don't much care. However, Sally, my wife, wants me to live forever.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm trying to accommodate her.
Yeah. Do you think you'll write more?
I have written lots and lots of short stories, which what would happen, I would, you know, do something, witness something, and I would write it down as a short story. So they're all factual. I could string them all together, I suppose. However, some of them, I think, would probably have to be published posthumously because they're sort of iffy, questionable. Morally wobbly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have a code you live by? Because I think there's a lot of codes you reject.
Yes, I do. I was still, well, I don't know if you remember, but towards the end of a school year, I would tell my classes, I would say that the world exists only because you can see it, because you can feel it, because you can taste it. Therefore, you're the world. You're sort of like God, because when you die, it all goes away. And yet, all of the adults, all of the governments who cannot prolong your life by 1 minute are telling you how to live that life. They're trying to take from you the only thing that you really have. So just remember that you're central. And they would all go, oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Oh, man, that's so deep. And then, of course, they you know, forget it.
Yeah. Yeah. What have we forgotten? I've said all my questions, and I know we still have a few minutes, but what do you think you would like our audience to know about?
I think we have pretty much covered it all, haven't we?
I think so. The book is called The Long Vacation. The author is Alex Panasenko. It is a short book. It is 146 pages. It's hard to put down. It reads very quickly. And I think it's $18 on Amazon. It's from the Irish Press.
$20. I think it's 20.
Yeah. So this book is... An amazing achievement. And it's your first book, but you've been writing for a long time.
It's my first and only book, yes.
Yeah. Alex Panasenko, thank you so much for being part of the New Books Network and for talking with me this fine afternoon.
Okay, Chris, take care. Good talking to you.